I next met with Dr. Andrew Zhu to chat about hepatocellular cancer and more. And to begin, I asked him what he considered perhaps the most important overall issue a clinician should consider when first evaluating a patient with HCC.
The key question that the medical oncologist should entertain when they see a patient with hepatocellular carcinoma is really to carefully evaluate the curative treatment modality that this particular patient may be entitled to. And what I mean by that is either surgical resection, liver transplantation, or local ablative therapy, particularly radiofrequency ablation, is actually very much curative in this setting. So I think the clinician really needs to look into these options very carefully. If you catch HCC at the early stage defined by the Milan criteria, and this is striking, the outcome is actually so overwhelmingly good in the neighborhood of 70 to 80% at 5-year disease-free survival, overall survival. And this is in contrast to some of the, you know, very aggressive tumor that we as GI medical oncologists deal with, for example, pancreatic cancer. Even when you catch an early pancreatic cancer with definitive procedure like WIPO procedure, the outcome is not even close. And that's why I always make a very strong point. You really need to evaluate these patients for definitive treatment. And also, obviously, that has significant implication for early diagnosis and increased awareness of this particular disease as well. But that's probably beyond the discussion today.
One thing I am curious about is how high in age can you go to do transplant? What's the oldest patient you've seen, for example?
Terrific question, Neil. Unfortunately, we are dictated by the transplant policy as defined by the UNOS. I think in New England and also, you know, in this country, the general cutoff has been 70 years old. But having said that, whether there will be some flexibility depending on the individual patient based on their performance status, underlying comorbidity, I have seen some flexibility over the years, but obviously this is purely a case-by-case basis.
Any sense about why the outcome, for example, is so much better with transplant than, for example, surgery? Do you think it's just the selection of patients or is it the treatment itself?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a very big debate. If you really match everything for surgical resection versus transplant, whether you actually, you know, really see the difference of the outcome. Suffice to say, I don't think that kind of study will ever be completed to the design that you and I would like, because they do actually targeting patients slightly differently. And what I mean by that is, you know, liver transplantation is still mainly targeting patients with early stage HCC, but also with underlying hepatitis C infection with either compensated or actually somewhat decompensated hepatic function. And I think, you know, the beauty of the transplant is really taking care of the hepatocellular carcinoma, but perhaps more importantly, it's really removing the underlying cirrhosis this patient has, which will in turn cause significant morbidity down the road. I think that's why when you have patients with early stage HCC, but also with underlying compromised hepatic function, by doing the transplant, you not only take care of the HCC, but also really removing the underlying predisposing environment for further development of HCC. And perhaps that contributes to the improved outcome for these patients. And also keep in mind, the underlying cirrhosis also contribute to significant comorbidity and also even mortality. So by, you know, really taking care of the underlying cirrhosis, you also improve the outcome for the underlying cirrhosis.
So another thing that I hear oncologists asking me questions all the time about is the issue of taste. And maybe one sort of basic point you might elaborate on a little bit I thought was really interesting is the blood supply and the difference between the blood supply to normal liver and tumor or HCC.
Yeah, you know, this is really fascinating in a sense that I think, you know, liver is really the unique organ that you actually have the dual blood supply. You have the hepatic artery perfusing the normal liver parenchyma as well as, you know, hepatocellular carcinoma in this setting, whereas the portal venous system, you know, is mainly responsible for the normal nutrient supply to the liver. So for this particular reason, we have been actually taking the advantage of the dual blood supply to target the tumor arising within the liver by many strategies. But I think the key concept is really based on the theoretical consideration that HCC or other tumors arising in the liver perhaps is deriving the blood supply mainly from the hepatic artery, whereas the normal parenchyma is deriving the blood supply mainly from the portal vein as well as the hepatic artery. So you can selectively define the blood flow to the tumor by angiogram defining the blood flow of the specific hepatic artery and its branches. So you can actually specifically engineer the therapeutic intervention strategy while you can achieve that, either by blocking the blood flow, injecting the chemotherapy-coated beads, and also, you know, recently, we can actually deliver the radio-labeled particles. So these are all the evolving technologies that we are developing, but it's purely based on the blood flow concept that we have been actually investigating for many, many years.
So what I hear oncologists asking about is, how do you figure out whether you're going to be primarily local treatment-directed, for example, with TACE, versus systemic treatment, sorafenib? So maybe you can talk a little bit about that decision, both in the patient with disease confined to the liver as well as the patient who's got metastatic disease.
I have to really emphasize that this is really perhaps one of the most controversial, but also, you know, rapidly evolving area. So the first controversy is that if you do have the vascular invasion, particularly if you have modest vascular invasion defined by segmental portal vein invasion, are you a candidate? I think the overwhelming clinical practice pattern is that as long as the interventional radiologist can safely administer TACE, even when you have patient with segmental portal vein invasion, this is still being practiced both in the States and also more extensively worldwide. And second controversial point is really, as you alluded earlier, if you have small volume of extrahepatic disease, let's say you have CT scan evidence of some regional lymph node enlargement or small pulmonary nodules, and do you still have benefit performing TACE in this setting? I think, unfortunately, we have no clinical studies guiding us whether you can actually still give the benefit to these patients when you perform TACE or other regional therapy when you have small volume of extrahepatic disease. But I have seen patients getting this kind of treatment from the community before they came to see me. I have to say that this is the area perhaps we can design some future clinical trial to address this specific question. But unfortunately, in the literature right now, you know, we really do not have any evidence to really guide us if you deliver TACE either alone in this setting or actually in combination with sorafenib, you can actually improve the outcome for these patients.
Another common question we get from oncologists about HCC is management of patients with child PUB and even C disease, specifically in terms of systemic therapy, for example, with sorafenib.
Yeah, so I get asked, and also, you know, I've seen a lot of these patients presenting with underlying either child B or child C. I have to say the easy answer is probably starting for patients with child C cirrhosis. I think we conceded for many years that this is the population perhaps we should not try to give sorafenib or actually putting these patients on some other empiric systemic therapies, or obviously to even consider these patients for trials. I think we have increasingly recognized having the worsening underlying cirrhosis, particularly when it gets to the category of child C. I think the best option that you can offer these patients is to really make sure that these patients has an adequate follow-up with the hepatologist so their cirrhosis-related complications can be actually managed to the state-of-the-art level, meaning the ascites is under control, the encephalopathy is prevented, and they don't have any catastrophic upper GI bleeding. I think the best you can offer these patients perhaps is really trying to either manage these yourself very carefully, or if you don't have the expertise, you send these patients to your hepatology colleagues so that these patients are not continuing to suffer from the cirrhosis-related problem. I think trying to make the existing HCC a little bit smaller, or actually, you know, trying to control them to be stable with either medication or with other interventional approaches that I mentioned earlier, I don't think you're doing a big service to these patients. If anything, you may actually invite more trouble to these patients based on my experience.
How about Child-Pugh B?
So for patients with underlying Child-Pugh B, I think the first thing that I want to emphasize is that the Child-Pugh classification is a very rough estimate of the underlying hepatic function. So not all Child-Pugh B are the same. So, you know, you definitely have the different scoring even for patients with underlying Child-Pugh B. But I think the message has been very clear after the sorafenib approval, after we have gained extensive clinical experience, and not by really well-designed clinical trial, but rather by either single institution cohort experience, the large Gideon study post-approval, as well as for the clinical experience many clinicians have gained, including myself. I think the message is that you can perhaps safely give sorafenib to patients with underlying Child-Pugh B, and particularly if they have the so-called B7 score. But I think we're very, very clear right now with the outcome data that even you deliver sorafenib to this population, I think the time treatment duration on sorafenib will be short, and also the time to tumor progression will definitely be short in general in comparison with patients with underlying Child A. So again, you can perhaps safely deliver the drug, and these patients may actually derive some benefit, but in general, I think the benefits tends to be shorter in this particular population. I don't think we can definitively answer the question, they are shorter because they truly do not derive the benefit to the same magnitude in comparison with patients with underlying Child A, or actually the underlying hepatic function just compromise their tolerability as well as their clinical deterioration. I think these questions are still not answered at this point.
And just for the non-HCC aficionados, I guess we should remind everybody that when you say 7, that technically Child-Pugh B can be a 7-point or 9-point at its worst stage. So I guess really the more favorable side of Child-Pugh B seems like where you might think about it and others think about it. What about dosing in that situation?
Yeah. So dosing remains to be a very controversial topic. As you recall, the SHARP study as well as the Asian Pacific trial have really tested the dose at 400 milligrams twice a day. And this is really where we have the level one evidence that sorafenib has actually improved the overall survival in comparison with placebo. I think in daily clinical practice, I've seen increasingly that some oncologists have started treating the patients with half of the dose at 400 milligrams, either divided twice with 200 milligrams BID or given 400 milligrams daily. And then to assess their tolerability, if they tolerate, they can actually be gradually escalated to the target full dosage. I have seen this kind of practice quite often. I have to say that I use this particular strategy. If I see patients with borderline performance status, as well as for patients with Child-Pugh B, I actually find this particular strategy a little bit more on the conservative side so that you don't actually induce some of the toxicities associated with sorafenib leading to the early discontinuation. So I have find this kind of strategy really having some very practical benefit. But I think right now we really do not have the data to compare that if you start patient with full dosage versus if you start with, say, 50%, but then escalate them as they tolerate, whether you achieve somewhat improved tolerability with the second strategy, and more importantly, whether you can actually improve the drug exposure, treatment duration, and also time to tumor progression. I haven't seen a well-designed study addressing this particular question. So I think moving forward, this question perhaps will continue to be with us in the clinical practice. In this case, I will urge the community oncologists to continue to use the performance status assessment, the underlying hepatic function, assess them carefully when you make this clinical decision. I think, you know, suffice to say, if the patient is very young, has very robust performance status, has compensated hepatic function, I think full dosage at 400 milligram BID continues to be the standard. But in exceptional cases, as I alluded earlier, I think considering a dose reduction at the beginning to make sure that the patient can actually tolerate the dose reduction scheme at the beginning and then gradually escalate them as they demonstrate the tolerability to full dosage, I think making a lot of sense.
So what about the patient who is robust and, as you say, has good liver function, but is 70 to 75, you want to start sorafenib full dose or not?
Yeah, so I get asked a lot about the age issue. And also, you know, I constantly wrestle with this kind of clinical decision when I see a patient coming in at the age of 75 with a newly diagnosed HCC. I think this is a very tough question to answer, giving a standard answer. Again, I think I will use the same criteria. I will not discriminate based on just the age. I will instead looking at the patient based on his or her performance status. And I think a robust young 75 should be actually given the fair opportunity to try the full dosage as well.
One more practical question. I was kind of interested and surprised that the oral ASCO HCC included a supportive care paper. In this case, it was looking at urea cream. What did you think about that paper?
So this is not a earth-shattering strategy that we have actually just noticed. As you know, as we appreciate the hand and foot skin reaction associated with sorafenib, I think we have actually tried many strategies trying either to manage the associated skin toxicity or actually even try to prevent or delay the appearance. I think the urea-containing cream is something that we actually have used in our practice. I think for that study to invoke so many patients on trial to really assess that question, I think even though it's a very logical question, but I think the study design is definitely not the best study design. As you recall, it is an open-label study, so that the clinician definitely has the bias whether to continue these longer or not. So I personally think if we truly want to address that question, I think we can come up with definitely a better design to address the issue, whether urea containing regimen can definitely decrease the skin toxicity associated with sorafenib use. So I think the study definitely has its merits. I'm glad that people are making this kind of efforts to address this, but I don't think that was actually the right study design to definitively answer this question.
Do you yourself do anything preemptively to prevent hand foot, or you just wait for it to occur?
Yeah, so, you know, it's a very interesting question. You know, I wish that I can say I have very good preventive strategy. I think in terms of the preventive strategy, I always encourage my patient to make sure that they actually moisturize their skin very carefully, particularly in the palms and soles. So these are the areas the skin, hand and foot skin reaction tend to occur early, more severely. So I tend to encourage the patient to keep their hands, skin moisturized. But beyond that, there's really no easy way to alleviate that. I think the other thing is you can try to decrease the pressure associated with this. You can encourage them to wear loose shoes so that they don't have to constantly put the pressure very tightly in their foot. But beyond that, pharmacological intervention as a preventive strategy, I have not been using that at this point.
So maybe you can just comment briefly on a huge topic that you're very involved with is biliary tract cancer and cholangiocarcinoma. And maybe you can just sort of capsulize what's new from a practical clinical perspective, but much more interestingly, what we're learning about the biology and what you're learning in your work about the biology of this disease or these diseases.
Yeah, so biliary tract cancers have been ignored for many years. I think in the past few years, we can actually appreciate that there's some renewed interest for several practical reasons, in my opinion. The first, perhaps, is that it's probably not as rare as we used to think. As we all know, that intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma incidence is actually rising for reasons we're not completely clear. So we're actually seeing increased incidence for intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma in our practice. Secondly, I think we're starting to appreciate that this particular type of tumor is perhaps not as chemo-resistant as some other tumor types. I think if you actually give gemcitabine cisplatin-based treatment to very heterogeneous cholangiocarcinoma population, you will induce a radiographic response rate close to 30%. So this is much higher than pancreatic cancer, much higher than HCC in general. Third, I think we increasingly recognize that all biliary tract cancers are not the same. I think there are definitely differences in clinical presentation, clinical behavior, and more importantly, perhaps they actually have underlying biology difference among the different biliary tract cancers. So gallbladder cancer, distal bile duct cancer may actually behave differently in comparison with intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. And we have actually tried to interrogate the heterogeneity of the molecular signature of these tumors within the past few years. We and others have actually shown some very interesting unique mutation pattern as well as new mutations for some of the biliary tract cancer subtypes, particularly the intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. And we have actually just recently identified a new type of mutation in the so-called IDH gene, which is actually another very interesting new type of genetic mutations that we have initially found in glioma, in AML, and also in chondrosarcoma. And more recently, we actually surprisingly find that the signature appears to be present in a very significant number of patients in intrahepatic cholangiocarcinoma. We're starting to assess the relevance of these different genetic mutations with regard to their potential sensitivity to various known target agents, and also more importantly, to some of the newer agents under clinical development. So my sense is that I think the GemCis, GemMox, or GemCapecitabine combination chemotherapy remains to be the state-of-the-art first-line treatment. I think the field is ready to answer the question whether adding another target agent in the first-line setting perhaps will be actually able to improve the outcome even further. And also, you know, for those who fail the second-line setting, perhaps we should actually develop more effective treatment. And third, I think we should definitely take the advantage of the molecular signature differences among the various subtypes of biliary tract cancer, and also the known availability of different target agents that actually inhibit various known targets in carcinogenesis in biliary tract cancers. Perhaps we can actually see a more important clinical benefit in this very challenging subgroup of patients. And lastly, I just want to add, I think the approval pathway for any new drug in this disease is actually relatively straightforward. So this is actually a very nice platform, you know, if you have a very terrific agent to actually be tested, if the results is overwhelmingly impressive, and perhaps you can even accelerate the approval process, you know, for orphan disease like biliary tract cancers.